Welcome, writers, advocates, activists, revolutionaries, change makers, and just good literary citizens. I'm here with one of the best author advocates I know, my co-host, Brooke Warner. And Brooke, I'm using these words that usually describe people in political terms because, one, I think we often don't recognize the politics that are inherently part of being a writer. And then, two, the world has changed quite a bit since we last recorded together in late May. And the writing and publishing world has been part of that change and will hopefully keep changing and even leading change. I'm glad that we have one of those people who is helping to change the world on the show today, the author L.L. McKinney, who is a writer advocate who started the recent Publishing Paid Me hashtag.
Yeah, I'm not only glad, I'm also very honored that we're having this conversation today and that LL has agreed to join us. And for those of you who might have missed the Publishing Paid Me story, it started in early June with a response on Twitter to publishing industry professionals taking a day off in protest and in solidarity with Black Lives Matter. And the YA author, Toshi Anyabuchi, tweeted essentially, look, that's real cute that you all are supporting Black Lives Matter, but let's just talk about the money. And, you know, he was calling out the industry on the disparities between advances paid to white authors and the advances paid to Black authors. And this disparity, of course, exists between white authors and all authors of color. But the reason it was focused on Black authors was because of this day of solidarity, which was specifically in support of Black Lives Matter. So Toshi was saying, look, your day of solidarity is not enough. And LL responded, and she's going to talk about this story a little bit more deeply when we get to interview her. But she's like, do y'all need a hashtag? Here's one, Publishing Paid Me. And boy, did it go viral. So some of the better known writers and authors that weighed in include Roxane Gay, Jesmyn Ward, and Kiese Layman. And the hashtag and the many authors who shared their advances opened the door to a much needed conversation about how the industry lowballs Black authors. And it offered some serious transparency into who gets paid what. And by the Monday following the hashtag going viral, a Google spreadsheet that had collected the advances of 1,200 authors also went viral. So this is just an example of the power of social media and advocacy, you know, from writers like LL, and how it works for good and change and for progress.
Yeah, definitely a good side of social media. And any writer who posted their advance deserves deep gratitude because it takes guts to be that open. And we need that kind of openness to make the publishing world more fair and equitable. I have to say that the publishing industry is notoriously opaque, which works against authors, especially in terms of pay. It's always been dumbfounding to me why one book might receive a 6 or 7 figure advance and another book might receive $10,000. But the Publishing Paid Me hashtag not only showed the random of the disparity among advances in general, it showed a very severe and real racial inequity. I read about the Google spreadsheet you mentioned, Brooke, and of the 1,200 entries at the time I read about it, I think there are more now, there were 122 writers who said they earned at least $100,000. So 78 of those 122 identified as white, 7 as Black, and 2 said they were Latin American. So that's not a scientific study, but I think it's very telling and very likely very accurate. Just a couple of stories about Black authors illustrate the inequity. Jesmyn Ward, one of the most critically acclaimed novelists to speak out about Publishing Paid Me, wrote on Twitter that she fought and fought for her first $100,000 advance, even after her previous book, Salvage the Bones, for which she said she received around $20,000, won a National Book Award in 2011. She ended up having to switch publishers to negotiate a higher advance for her book, Sing, Unburied Sing, for which she won another National Book Award in 2017. But she said it was still barely equal to some of my writer friends' debut novel advances. And then a lot of people were astonished by N.K. Jemisin's story. She tweeted that she received $25,000 for each book in her Broken Earth trilogy. She won the Hugo Award, which recognizes excellence in science fiction and fantasy, 3 years in a row for each book in the trilogy. So that's definitely so amazingly low on the advance scale. I just can't believe it.
Yeah, it is pretty shocking. And I think that was the power of that kind of transparency. And yet none of this is surprising to anyone unless you completely have your head stuck in the sand. You know, it's eye-opening, but not surprising. And so LL has said in a couple of interviews that she was not surprised by the disparities that were revealed, but that she was hurt. And, you know, certainly I think that her feelings are echoed throughout the community of writers of color. And being part of this industry, I can tell you that there is and has been, for as long as I've been doing this, so over 20 years, a lot of hand-wringing that goes on about racial inequality and racial disparity in the publishing industry, and a lot of lip service without much change. So the systemic racism that exists in our country is being revealed in really forceful ways right now as the Black Lives Matter movement has gained a new level of visibility and also support, and as we witness these sustained national protests. And so I was very encouraged to see that CNN reported in June that two-thirds of the country supports Black Lives Matter. And so you have publishing, right, which is this microcosm of racial inequity. And you can probably look at any number of industries and dig in and see how hard Black people have had to fight to make it. But I know firsthand that publishing has actively worked to push Black people out of its ranks. I moderated a panel 2 years ago at Book Expo about diversity and the lack thereof in book publishing. And Christopher Jackson, who's the famed publisher and editor-in-chief of the One World imprint of Random House, was one of the panelists. And he shared a story of colleagues, well, multiple stories of colleagues who'd left the industry, Black colleagues specifically, for not getting promotions, for their ideas being outright dismissed, for countless microaggressions. And then there's the issue of money. Publishing pays terribly. So entry-level folks literally cannot afford to live in New York City. So this means that the workforce who can afford to take these entry-level agenting and publishing jobs are by and large being subsidized by their parents. So you automatically have a class system at play in publishing, which is truly troubling. When I was an entry-level editor, when I was 22 years old, I was making $11.50 an hour in a career kind of job. And I did have the support system, as I mentioned, that many of the people who can afford to take these jobs have. They were paying my car insurance and my health insurance at the time. And I still had to get a waitressing job to make ends meet because I couldn't have otherwise afforded to live in Berkeley. So Lee & Low Books has been issuing a survey about publishing's diversity problem for years now, and they find that the industry is more than three quarters white. When I look around in publishing, it seems even higher than that. They've also written about how there's a prevailing myth among publishers that Black people don't buy books. They've unveiled what happens for Black authors if their first book doesn't do well, that is nearly impossible to get a second contract. I'd argue this is true for a lot of authors, but certainly white authors often get a pass. You know, they'll get a second chance in ways that writers of color don't. And then the other thing is that the publishing industry doesn't get people of color, in part because there are not a lot of people of color working in their offices. And so if there are no staff of color, for instance, on the marketing team, and then that all white team is saying, well, we don't know how to market to people of color, it's a pretty self-fulfilling prophecy. And then they're trying to say, you know, people of color don't read. So it's a fallacy to begin with. And it's obviously, you know, evident if anyone who wants to go onto Bookstagram and Twitter and see just the inordinate influence of Black writers and readers there. So, you know, you got to know where to look, publishing.
Thanks for laying that all out, Brooke. You know, this is one of those moments when I've realized how little I truly know how things work, in part because I don't work or haven't worked in publishing. And I read some articles that, you know, went into detail about some of the things you just mentioned about the inner workings of publishing companies. And I thought about how individual acquiring editors or individual marketers might have the best intentions, but if they're working within a larger system that is predominantly white, then there's going to be a prevailing bias that determines what books are acquired and for how much, and then how much marketing budget to put into them and how they're marketed. So the publishing industry really is a case study in systemic racism. In other words, if you want to understand systemic racism, what it is, then read about the structure of publishing and who holds those jobs. The publishing paid me hashtag and all the articles it generated, it is an educational and galvanizing moment for all authors because it's making public what is often hidden. That's what's wonderful about it. And as I mentioned earlier, the way writers get paid is just odd and often random and definitely unfair for a good deal of the time. Getting a good advance is most akin to winning the lottery. I'd love to do some math around this, but I think most authors earn minimum wage or possibly less for their books if you figure in all the time it takes to write the book, deal with editing, then promote the book. And that's not including all of the years you've spent building your skills as a writer that goes unpaid. Since you worked as an editor at a publisher, Brooke, could you explain how this crazy, runic, Byzantine advance system worked? or doesn't work?
Yeah, actually, back in March, I wrote an article for Publishers Weekly called The Trouble with Big Deals. And I also wrote about advances in my book, Write On Sisters. There, specifically, I wanted to give historical context about advances and how agents were originally the ones to push for advances in the early 1900s. And this set up the cultural precedent of the advance being tied to an author's worthiness. But basically, an advance has become synonymous with the publisher's belief in an author. It's kind of like you're going to lay down what you think your author can do. And so there becomes a correlation between the money a publisher puts down for a book and what kind of effort they're going to put behind the book. Because of course, you're not going to spend $500,000 for the rights to a particular book and then put no marketing dollars behind it, right? The problem is that huge advances can and do set up authors for failure, because if they don't earn out their advance, which means recouping the money that the publisher spent on the book's production and the advance, they don't get a second contract. And so it can be very career ruining. A six-figure advance is actually quite difficult to earn out. In this kind of current publishing climate where there are so many books being published each year, it looks a lot different today in the 2020s than it did in the 1980s or 1990s, where you could spend, say $100,000 on a book and then that author could hope to earn out because there was just a lot less competition. So suffice it to say, advances are really fraught, not only because of the disparities we're talking about today between white authors and authors of color, but just generally because there can be so much hype around advances. I've written about how book publishers behave a lot like problem gamblers, and this is tied to the kind of attention that big advances get, right? Like you'll put a lot of money out on a book and then that becomes a news story in and of itself. We talked about American Dirt. We've talked about it a bit recently because it was a book that got a multi six-figure advance. And a book like that would have never been an Oprah pick if it hadn't come with such a huge advance. And in fact, it probably also would not have gotten the kind of negative attention it got if it had not gotten such a huge advance. So advances have all kinds of ramifications for authors.
Yeah. I've been thinking of a conversation we had with Jane Friedman on an earlier episode of Right Minded. And Jane remarked on how writing and publishing has really always been about class and race and infantilizing the author. Is that the right way to say that? Before very recent times, most of the people who got to be authors were people either of an upper class or they were supported by patrons, up until very, very recently, which means they almost were entirely white and men, at least in Europe and the United States. And Jane spoke about how writers, they were supposed to go off and create their great works, write their stories, and not bother themselves with issues of money. And that view of writers has really persisted, which is why the publishing industry has taken a patronizing view towards writers in general. Writers are often kept out of the business discussions around their books, for example. They tend to scramble desperately for advances, and then they're overjoyed and happy to get them, and they're supposed to be, super grateful. And they are to an extent, because frankly, authors need love and belonging like few others because of all the rejection they have to go through to get there. And I've been thinking of the sports world, especially the NBA basketball, which has changed dramatically because athletes have seized upon the leverage they have and they're using it to call the shots. And I hope something similar happens in publishing. Elle actually mentions this in her interview about authors banding together to make a statement and leave the room if they need to. So that's why it's important, that writers came together in a moment like publishing paid me to start using their leverage and essentially flip the power structure so that's more equitable.
Yeah, phew, Grant, this is such important stuff. And honestly, this topic could be a series all its own. So we're look forward to talking to Elle and her take on it and, just being an author in the trenches and being out there and in front of this enough to start an important conversation. So we're lucky to have her and hear what insights she has now, a full month plus after the hashtag went live.
Yeah, me too, Brooke. So without further ado, let's get to it just as soon as we're back from our short break. Brooke, I wanted to tell you about this little writing event that I'd like to tell people about because I think it might help them get inspired to do the heavy lifting on their writing projects. It's cool because it's produced hundreds of amazing books, including bestsellers, and thousands of people do it each year. And beyond realizing their creative dreams, many people just say it's a lot of fun. And it's free, which is cool.
It sounds like just the kind of event that many writers need, Grant. How can I find out more about it?
Well, you can go to nanowrimo.org. It's kind of a silly name, NaNoWriMo, which is an acronym for National Novel Writing Month, which happens every November. And the challenge is to write 50,000 words of a novel in a month. The idea is that a goal and a deadline is a creative midwife, and not to write your novel or memoir someday, but to do it today. Also, there's an amazing community of people who participate both online and in person. So it's like a rollicking party and a writing boot camp all at once.
And why the heck does it take place in November?
Because if you can write a novel during November, then you can write a novel anytime. Also, November is a dark and rainy month for many. So it's a good month to stay inside and write. And many people have leftover Halloween candy, which is known to fuel novel writing.
And you said memoirists can participate?
Yeah, a memoir is just a novel shelved in the nonfiction section by my definition. The main thing is to write, to banish your inner editor and focus on getting a first draft done because you can't edit a blank page.
That's amazing, Grant. I am going to sign up for this thing called NaNoWriMo.
It's not a newly discovered eel. It's not one of Jupiter's moons. It's not a mountain outside of Kathmandu. It's a novel writing event waiting for you at NaNoWriMo.org. Sign up now and start planning your novel. Welcome back, everybody. I'm super excited to introduce our featured guest today, L.L. McKinney, who is a writer, a poet, and an active member of the Kidlit community. She is the author of A Blade So Black, A Dream So Dark, and A Crown So Cursed. She's also an advocate for equality and inclusion in publishing and the creator of the hashtag WhatWOCWritersHear, and most recently the hashtag PublishingPaidMe. She spent time in the slush piles by serving as a reader for Agent, and she's also a gamer girl and an adamant Hey Hey Stan. Welcome, LL.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as a way for our listeners to get to know you, L, I read an interview with you where you said that if anyone ever writes a biography about you, you'd choose either Angie Thomas or Nick Stone. And I'm just going to ask about Nick because she was on Right Minded recently and she's participated in NaNoWriMo. And I know you've participated in NaNoWriMo, which is so cool. So I'm curious why you chose Nick and how she would portray you as a writer.
I chose Nick because of a communal love for, even though now it's kind of a painful subject, Harry Potter, as well as other blurty things and nerdy things. Nick is just really down to earth and super into her fandoms, like to a degree that upon first meeting her, you wouldn't think she was that much of a fanatic, but she really is. She's like a sleeper fanatic where it just comes out of left field and you're like, wait, what? But then you realize, oh, it's been there all along. And I think she would portray me pretty similarly, just, you know, knowing how we interact in person and online, just very, it would be one of those things where it's like, this is what you get, you know, from Elle whenever she's on panels or whatever. But this is also kind of what we get from Elle, you know, just being a person as opposed to author Elle. So I think she'd blend the two very well.
Cool. Can you tell me a little bit about your early or your first NaNoWriMo, how you discovered it and why you did it?
Oh, I don't remember how I discovered it. I'm fairly certain that it was somewhere on the internet and it was like, oh, 50,000 words in a month. I can do that. This was back before I had made like a habit of writing as often as possible. So it was quite difficult. And I remember working on the very first novel that I wrote with the intention of being published. Because there's a novel that I wrote, you know, yonder years, wee L's child, that I didn't realize I was writing Power Ranger fan fiction because I had no idea what fan fiction was. I was 12. But so that was like the very first like book length thing that I ever did. But this one happened probably mid-2000s and or early 2000s, now that I think about it. And it was mostly late night scramblings, usually from like midnight to 3 a.m. because I lived with my parents along with like my other sisters. There were four of us. There was a lot of people in the house. And the only time you got to be by yourself was when everyone else was asleep. So I forewent sleep for most of the month of November and then caught up around Christmas break.
So, Elle, I want to thank you and congratulate you for starting the Publishing Paid Me hashtag, which is certainly one of the most important hashtags and internet moments in recent publishing history. And it sparked this important conversation that seems like it could actually affect real industry change. So I'm wondering if you could tell us about this moment in response to Tochi Onyebuchi's tweet and whether you had any idea that the hashtag would gain that kind of traction.
We had no idea. Like, this is a conversation that Black authors and other professionals, we've been having in our circles for years, decades even. And then, you know, the non-Black people in our circles were also part of the conversations, but it never seemed to expand beyond the people who were connected to us in some way. And so this thing is happening, you know, after George Floyd and everybody. And these companies, including the Big Five, are, you know, jumping once again on the Black Lives Matter bandwagon, where it's in this moment, we have to say something, otherwise people look at us weird. And it's like, well, you don't really care, do you? So Tochi had tweeted, you know, hey, if you, I'm paraphrasing here, but white authors, you're going to have to be willing to have this uncomfortable conversation if you want to do this equality thing. And there were a bunch of responses, right? There were people who were like, oh yeah, let's do it. I'm down. Let's go. But nobody was putting up numbers. And I just got frustrated in a moment of, you know, just frustrating. The world is on fire in unique ways in 2020. So I was like, you guys do the thing that you said you were going to do. Like, don't tell us you're going to do it. Don't tell us you want to do it. Just do the thing. What do you want permission? And for like 15 minutes, nobody did anything. And so literally I'm like, do you need a hashtag? Here's a hashtag. Publishing paid me. Please do the thing. And a couple of people responded. And I honestly didn't think that it would get more than maybe a few hundred in responses. The usual people who respond to that type of call. But then it sort of took off. And then you have, you know, like Roxane Gay and Kane Jemerson and all these other people responding and, you know, poking at their people, their circles, and telling them to respond. And it just, we did not anticipate it happening, but we were very ready to take advantage of it. And so people are crunching numbers. Tochi's got some initiatives that he's heading with the information that's currently coming in, that's still being gathered to this day. It's only been like a month. And I know for a fact that people are using it when it comes to negotiating for what we're worth, Black authors. I know it's had an effect in at least a few people's abilities to say, hey, so you're going to put up or shut up. So it really was born out of decades of frustration that's been mounting for longer than I've been writing, for longer than I've been alive, honestly. And that just seemed, I don't know, cliche phrase, like the perfect storm of, yeah, people are paying attention to us now in a way that they should be paying attention to us all the time. But I don't know. I don't know if it could be repeated without everything that happened outside of publishing happening. And it's a shame that it took, you know, Black people being tortured and killed in the streets for it to have this effect. But I mean, that it is what it is at this point.
Yeah, it's good to hear that you're seeing the beginning of change. And I hope that continues because there were a lot of shocking and disturbing stories revealed in the hashtag. Like, I'm thinking of Jesmyn Ward and then Kate Jemison, who really stood out for me, especially because of how little they were paid after winning the biggest awards that an author can possibly win, you know. And you mentioned that you weren't surprised by the disparities that were revealed, though, but you were hurt by how deep it went. And so I was wondering if you can talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, it's, again, these are conversations that Black authors have been having for a while. Like, this isn't something that we didn't know. Mm-hmm. Because we had numbers from, like I said, the small circles that went around our circles, the people and the allies who we knew. But yeah, they shared our numbers because the authors talk. This is what we do. You know, regardless of race, you talk business. And so we knew that this was a thing. We didn't know how big of a thing it was. Like, for random comparison, it's like, okay, yeah, the state of Massachusetts exists. We're going to say that. We assume that Massachusetts exists and that it is bigger than a city. But then it comes along Texas and you're like, whoa, okay, didn't know it could get that big. Didn't know it would be bigger than a city, though. So this is just, you know, it does have nothing to do with each other, but just size comparison. Like, mentally, it's mm-hmm. like expecting to hit Massachusetts and then you see Texas there. So it was really painful for a lot of people to just see that, yeah, not only are you devalued, but this is how much you're devalued, where somebody who's been at this for years has done the one thing, like, nobody, it's not that N.K. Jemisin is the first Black author to do this thing with Hugo's. She's the first author, period. Period. Nobody before her has done this. And to see somebody who's never written a book before come in at near $1 million for a book, in some cases, over $1 million for, and it's just, it's insulting to a degree that I didn't know I could be insulted.
It's interesting to hear you talk, Ellen. I think you're capturing the outrage of so many writers of color right now. And this is exposing, like you're saying, though, we've always known. And I think that, you know, the industry has always known, but it's so opaque and consistently unfair. And I'm just curious, you know, when you're reconciling all of this, I mean, not that it can be reconciled, but how do you see your own experience in publishing so far, you know, and where you think you'll go from here, just in terms of what's being unveiled?
So far, I feel, I mean, the same thing happened to me that happened to everybody else, drastically underpaid for compared to, you know, other authors. Also, authors who, there's this whole thing where you saw where people would get deal after deal after deal, but the book in, you know, technical, like, it flopped, it didn't earn out. But yet they get this second chance for twice as much money as the first book, which makes no sense business, like, just no sense. And then you have, you know, Black authors who will earn out barely, like, it like, they either just make it and they break even, or it's right below it, or they'll even earn out and then earn a profit, but won't get the second and third chance because it didn't earn out enough, I guess. You know, enough to warrant taking the quote unquote risk on these types of stories. There's also this issue with, you know, a lot of that goes into the advance, which is just one aspect of it. It's about how publishing does or doesn't see how universal a story is. And it tells you which stories they view as being universal, which are white stories through a white lens. And it's, I mean, that's, you know, tale as old as time. It's not just publishing that does that. TV does it. Hollywood does it. It's this idea that these specific stories are the only ones that people can view themselves in, for obviously racist reasons. But it's just for me, I'm now armed with this information. It's like, I know my numbers. I know what I was paid beforehand. I know what I am, you know, making it capable of. And it's one of those things where it's like, you don't be afraid to walk away. Like, there's this idea that, you know, Black authors especially, you should be grateful for being allowed into the room, let alone being given a small chair at the kiddie table. Mm-hmm. How dare you even expect more? It's like, no, I will leave the room, and if you're not careful, I'll burn it down before I go. So it's one of those things where you just have to sort of be willing to say, not unless you give me what I'm worth. No.
I love how A Blade So Black combines Alice in Wonderland with Buffy, and how you've populated the novel with such a diverse cast of characters, and how you've reinterpreted Alice as a character who likes anime, cosplay, and rock music. So can you tell us more about how you conceived of A Blade So Black, and what advice do you have for prospective writers trying to take aspects from a classic tale and mold it into something new and unique?
Well, for A Blade So Black, it was honestly just two things that I enjoy sort of colliding in a really weird way. So I tell this story, and I was sitting on my mom's couch watching Supernatural reruns, as one does. This was like 10, 15 years ago. And they're hunting vampires. Supernatural has really weird vampires. And they made a Buffy reference, right? And earlier that day, I don't remember where I had seen it, but I had seen and read that Disney was going to be doing a live action Alice in Wonderland remake, you know, back before, or maybe this is what started the remakes that they're now doing of all their classics. And so my immediate thought was, nobody asked for this, Disney, thank you. But then I move on to, well, if this is, you know, live action, are they doing an entire remake? Is this going to be real and not some little girl's acid trip, which is what the book is said to be, as long, you know, commentary or whatever. So if it's real, that means the Jabberwocky is real. How do you deal with a Jabberwocky? Maybe she has, you know, some swords or something. So I wrote a fight scene, and I liked it. I'm pretty good at fight scenes, so I've been told. And I kept going, and it births the, you know, Alice pops up, and it's very much like the beginning of the book where she's sitting around being bait for these monsters, which it was the Jabberwocky in the beginning. And the person who told her to do this, because this wasn't her idea, she would never do this, you know, yeah, this is what I'm going to do. He drops in, and it's Addison Hatto, who's my version of the Mad Hatter, and they have this banter, and I just built off of that. And so the idea formulated by questioning Disney's choices and the Winchesters. That is how I got that initial idea. So that's how I do reimaginings, which is what I like to call that particular story. And that's the best I could say to do it, is combine two things that you love that maybe you didn't think would go together, like Buffy and Alice in Wonderland. Who knew? But it worked out.
Well, all your passion for your work and also for your advocacy is shining through in today's interview, and thank you. But both of those things, being an author and an advocate, are full-time jobs. So I'm wondering, do you have any parting words of guidance for authors who want to be more involved on the level of advocating for change, and especially now for publishing industry change?
I would say, at first, because this is what I did, because I didn't know what I didn't know in the beginning. Watch and listen to people who talk about it. Read all the things, articles, essays, memoirs from people who have done and are doing the work. Because as a good friend of mine, Danielle Clayton, often says, we stand on the shoulders of giants. Like, nobody is doing this work by themselves. We're building on the efforts of people who have come before us, which is why we can go even higher. And hopefully the people who come after me will be able to reach higher heights because of whatever I happen to leave behind. So there's nothing wrong with taking time to learn how to do this, because there's nothing that can hurt the cause more than regurgitating social justice rhetoric without having any idea what it means in various contexts. So just take your time. The fight will still be there.
Thanks so much, Elle. This has been inspiring.
Thank you for having me.
We will be right back with Grant's Takeaway.
For this week's takeaway, I was thinking how we've talked a lot about being a good literary citizen as a writer, but we haven't talked about how advocacy is part of being a good literary citizen. So today's takeaway is a request to you to start following publishing hashtags and to get involved in these conversations on Twitter or other social media platforms, of course. And I'm just going to list some of the main ones, the important ones that are worth following. There's Publishing Paid Me, of course, which Elle started. There's Black Publishing Power. And there's Blackout Bestseller List. And then finally, there's another one that Elle started way before Publishing Paid Me, and it's What WOC Writers Hear. So while hashtags are not necessarily activism in and of themselves, they are conversation starters, and they are often calls to action. You can learn a lot and be galvanized just by reading the posts. So if you want to be in the conversation, Twitter and Bookstagram are both great places to wade into, and I urge you to do so.
Thanks for that, Grant. And Everybody, you know that Right Minded is a weekly podcast, and we're happy to be bringing you authors, but also things that matter in the publishing industry. We are in the middle of a lot of interesting things going on. I can't remember a year more exciting than 2020, just in terms of all the stuff and possibility for change that is happening, you know, even though it's coming at a cost, as Elle mentioned today. So find us on Apple Podcasts. Please tell a friend. We really appreciate it. Help us expand our reach, and we will see you next week with another inspiring guest.